Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation. It was in the 1950s and in the middle of nowhere, Wisconsin, when Ed Gein began to unleash his wrath on the world. An inspiration for the villainous characters in the movie Psycho, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and the Silence of the Lambs, Gein's crime set a precedent that very few killers have lived up to. Now you may want to sit down for this horror story, as it is not for the faint of heart. This is True Crime Cast.
Welcome back to True Crime Cast. As always, I'm Jamie here with John. What's good, bud?
Hey, man. It's another day in the booth with you, buddy, so it's just a good day. We're in a new booth today.
Yeah, I have changed jobs. We used to record in my office, so now we're going to try out some different locations in our town and see what works so far. This one's not great. It's funny, because you're being nice and I'm being honest.
This is your space, so I'm not going to knock it too hard, at least on the air.
All right, Luke, before we get going, John, we got a lot of thank yous to give out. We issued a challenge last week that if we could get to 100 patrons on our Patreon page, we would offer phone calls to everyone. And we've had several people respond to that. We have had Kaylee, Uberchick, Alexis, and Krista Van come in at our $3 level, and we had Julie come in at our $7 level, which means she's going to get an autographed picture of us.
Yeah, we also have a few more. We have Carrie, who came in at the $7 level, so thank you, Carrie. We have Angie, who came in at the $3 level. We have Aiden, who came in at the $7 level, so thank you so much. We have Rachel, Jess, and Angie that came in at the $3 level. So, guys, we are so thankful to have you. You guys don't know how much it means to us that you're here. We have a new episode dropping at the beginning of every month that is just for our Patreon members. Jamie's already sent me the kind of the file for what we're going to do at the beginning of September, and it's going to be murder case, and we don't do a lot of murder on that show. So I'm looking forward to getting to that. I think it's going to be a really good case.
Yeah, I think there's some interesting turns to that one that we don't cover a lot. May get to a couple cases there, actually, that are related. Tonight, John, I'll go ahead and give the warning. We get a lot of positive reviews because we don't glorify the gore. We don't go into the disgusting details of the cases. We try to be really compassionate. We're talking about Ed Gein today, and we have to talk about some things that are uncomfortable. There's no way getting around it. So that's coming at some point. We are not going to go, we're going to make it as appropriate as we can, but there's going to be some uncomfortable things that happen. So please consider yourself warned.
I got to be honest. I didn't know that much about this case. If you listen to our other show, Bless Their Hearts, you guys will know that I don't watch a lot of movies. So this guy and the movies that have been based on him, I didn't know that much about. So when I started researching this case, I'm thinking, Jamie, this is not like you to pick something so hard to cover.
We've talked about it before that John usually picks these cases, and I usually spend the majority of the episode looking at my phone so I don't have to think about the awful details. I don't know why I chose this. I felt like it's overdue for us to cover such a famous case. So I feel like we needed to do it, and it was time, and we're going to do it in the best True Crime Cast fashion that we can.
Well, Jamie, this is certainly your case, and you have done the bulk of the research, so why don't you get the ball rolling?
Edward Theodore Gein was born in La Crosse, Wisconsin, on August 27th of 1906. His parents were Philip and Augusta Gein. He also had an older brother named Henry, who was about 5 years older than Ed. Philip was an alcoholic, and he was a fairly irresponsible guy. He had trouble keeping a job and really didn't do as much as he could have to support the family. So Augusta, Ed's mom, was really in charge of the house. She ran a grocery store and owned that and operated it. Yes, Philip helped, but she was really in charge of that as well. They ultimately sold that to move further away from society, and we're going to go a little bit into why Augusta wanted that to happen. But in 1915, they moved away from La Crosse and settled on a farm in Plainsfield, Wisconsin. This isolation was very intentional by Augusta. She wanted to shelter her boys from the quote-unquote evils of the world, and she preached that to them daily. She told them about how evil the world was, and especially how the women out there wanted to seduce their boys and to ruin their lives. So she was very much a hellfire and brimstone, the world's evil, we need to stay together because we're the only people doing good out there. So she moved them out to a huge farm so that they would be secluded from society. It's said that Ed idolized his mom, and that made his brother Henry feel really uncomfortable. And Henry had apparently confronted Augusta about this a few times, telling her that her relationship with Ed wasn't healthy. And obviously she didn't appreciate that feedback. Their father, Philip, died in 1940 from an apparent heart failure. And at that point, Henry and Ed became in charge of the farm. So they also had to start doing handyman jobs and odd jobs around town just to support the family.
And Jamie, they were apparently very well liked in town. They were known as honest, hardworking young men. Ed would even occasionally babysit for people in town, which Jamie, in retrospect, after we get through all of this case, that is going to be a very creepy thing to keep in the back of your mind, that this dude watched children. In 1944, a brush fire broke out on the farm, so Henry and Ed went out to fight it. And ultimately, Jamie, it did not overtake the farm, but Henry did not survive. It was under very suspicious circumstances. However, Ed reported him missing to police and said that he had lost them when they were fighting the fire. However, he then led police directly to Henry's body. So that's just, you know, that's kind of an odd thing in and of itself. There were very deep bruises on Henry's head when police found his body, but the death was still ruled as an accident and was blamed on the fire. They did this without really any kind of actual investigation or any kind of autopsy. There was obvious speculation that Ed was involved in Henry's death, especially since Henry had been at odds with Augusta. So, Jamie, I'm going to stop there and let's process this just a little bit. Do you think that he had something to do with his brother's death?
I do. I mean, you mentioned the bruising on the head, and it looked like he had been hit in the head, definitely. And the fact that Ed said he lost him, but then led police straight to Henry's body, and he was burned up, but he wasn't necessarily in an area that was burned up, from what I understand. So it sounds like everything about this was suspicious, but everybody loved Ed. Everybody respected him, so they felt like he was being honest and didn't really thoroughly look into this.
Yeah, so now it seemed like Ed and Augusta had exactly what they wanted, and that it was just going to be them from then on, or so it seemed. It wasn't long before Augusta had a stroke, which she lived through. Ed dedicated himself to taking care of her, but she passed away after a short time, and she had had a second stroke and died on December 29th, 1945. At this point, Ed was all alone on the secluded farm, and based on his mother's brainwashing that the world was just evil, being alone was going to prove not to be a good thing for him.
And it really wasn't a good thing for anybody. John, a story I read was that the second stroke, the one that ultimately would kill Augusta, happened as they were visiting someone, and they saw a dog. She saw a dog being abused, and she was so mad at the owner abusing that animal that she worked herself up and had a second stroke. So her, I guess, anger toward the world ultimately, I guess, led to her demise. But once she died, if Ed was already an unstable individual, this made things much worse. It's reported that he boarded up the majority of the house to reserve the spaces that his mother lived in. So anywhere that she spent a lot of time, he didn't use at all. He completely boarded it up. He left the kitchen open, and he slept on a mattress in the floor of a room that was just off the kitchen. The space that he actually occupied was filthy, and when police would eventually raid the farm, they would see that the entire house was full of trash, except for the rooms that he had boarded up that were still in pristine condition. At some point, Ed would choose to sell off part of the farm to help make ends meet. It was 80 acres that his brother technically had owned before he passed away, so he sold almost half of what they owned. But again, he wasn't using that part himself to farm. To pass the time and to help make ends meet, he took up even more odd jobs than he had been taking, and he spent more time in town. He started hanging out in local bars, And although he would mostly keep to himself in public, John, he had a really good reputation as being a quiet guy that got along with everyone. And it's said that many police officers would interact with him at the bars, and they all liked him. They enjoyed talking to him. And again, they all trusted him. Ed also loved to read, which, when you say that, it sounds like a wonderful habit to get in. But the things he read were not, self-improvement books. It said that he read a lot of stories about cannibalism. He studied the human anatomy. He read a great deal about dissection and what that would look like of the human body. And he also read a lot about Nazis. So his reading wasn't exactly, how to help me be a better farmer or be a better handyman or whatever. He was reading things that were very out there, but make a lot more sense when we find out what he got into. There was also a lot of speculation about Ed's sexuality. His mother really messed with him and his perception of women with all her talk about them being evil and seductive and those kinds of things. There are people out there that believe that Ed wanted to be a woman based on some evidence we'll discuss later, and that he actually was idolized people who had sex changes, and that's what he wanted for his life. There were rumors that there were multiple times in his life when he considered castrating himself so that he wouldn't be a man anymore, or that he wouldn't be sexually attracted to women as much. But regardless of what was happening with his sexual identity, it wasn't long after his mother's death that his deviance began.
Yeah, and because of several factors, the timeline of all of his crimes are really difficult to nail down and be precise with. But as far as we know, on December 8th of 1994, there was a local bar owner named Mary Hogan who went missing. Now, she was the owner and operator of a place called Mary's Tavern. She was very well known and liked around town, and it was a very big deal when she disappeared. One evening, when sitting at the bar while police officers were discussing her disappearance, it's reported that Ed made the comment, and he said something along the lines of, "Yeah, I've got her over at my house." So, Jamie, because of everybody in town knew that Ed was a person that wouldn't really hurt anybody, the police officers kind of laughed it off, and that case went unsolved for many, many years. So fast forward to November 16th, 1957. That's when the owner of a hardware store named Bernice Warden disappeared in a very similar fashion to how Mary Hogan vanished. However, there was some evidence at the scene this time, which was different than when Mary disappeared. The fact that Bernice's son, whose name was Frank, was a deputy sheriff, I think that really helped the intensity of this investigation. So at the scene, they found blood on the floor and a receipt for antifreeze. Now, I know that if that's all you found, that's not a whole lot to go off of, right? But it's really important because a man by the name of Ed Gein had been in the store the evening before her disappearance, and he made some purchases, and Jamie, he said that he would be back the next morning to purchase antifreeze. On November 17th, 1957, Ed Gein was arrested and a search warrant was issued for his farm. And if you need another warning, I think this is when you take heed of that. Turn this off if you have a weak stomach or are going to be easily offended by some messed up stuff.
Yeah, maybe just hit that plus 30-second button a few times and keep checking in. And if you hear a body part, hit it again, because this is not a lot of fun for us to discuss. But then again, some people like this aspect of true crime. So once police arrived on the farm, they pretty quickly found the body of Bernice Warden. It was out in the shed. They found that she had been shot in the head by a .22 caliber rifle and that her head had been cut off. But it was when they went into the house when they realized what kind of monster that they were dealing with. Immediately upon going in the house, the first thing that they noticed, as I mentioned earlier, was the trash that was everywhere. The house was filthy, and it was hard to make out kind of what was trash and what was, I mean, even the furniture was so dirty. But then they started noticing some things that were obviously off. Even outside of the filth, they noticed some things that simply didn't fit. And here are just a few of those things. John, in the kitchen, they found some bowls that were made out of human skulls. they found kitchen utensils that were made out of bones. They found a lampshade, John, that was made from human skin, which included a face. They found chairs that were upholstered in human skin. They found organs found in jars. Bernice Warden's heart was actually found in a plastic bag in the kitchen. There was a belt made of human nipples. At one point, one of the officers found a brown paper bag. He stuck his hand inside because he thought it was just full of hair, and he was pulling the hair out. But when he pulled the hair out of the bag, a face came with it. Police immediately recognized this as the face of Mary Hogan.
I feel like we've covered a lot of brutal stuff on this show, but hearing you read that list was probably one of the grossest things I've ever heard. This is definitely one of the most brutal cases we've ever covered, but it's very real. There is an even longer list of stuff that you can read online, but we didn't want to put all of it in here, but we put some kind of the big things, some of the highlights. But yeah, man, you hear about this stuff and you see it like on scary movies and you think this is just made up. This is like from the evil imagination of somebody who created the show, but this actually happened. Police actually found all of those things on Ed's farm.
It really is unbelievable, John, the things that they found. I mean, you and I listen to a lot of true crime stuff, and I know you really like real life, real crime, where he comes up with some surprising scenarios that you don't expect. But even as an officer, I think you see a lot of graphic things, and you kind of learn what to expect going into a murder scene or whatever. But I don't think anybody on earth was prepared to walk in and see these things. And I just, like, what kind of trauma could that cause a person? I can't even fathom the images that were in their mind when they were trying to sleep at night for several months and years after that.
I mean, I would go a step further to say that I don't think you ever forget that kind of stuff. I think that, you know, there's going to be times 40 years after you've retired that you close your eyes and you're going to see the face of Mary coming out of that bag. You know, that's incredibly traumatizing. So, dude, Ed was obviously a monster. There were numerous bodies that were used to make all of these things. During his interrogation, he quickly admitted to killing Bernice Warden, which they had found her body and head one day after she disappeared, so he didn't really have any way to get out of that. After a few days, he admitted to the murder of Mary Hogan. Again, they pretty much had verified that they had found her face in his home. There were apparently a lot of unsolved murders in Plainfield, Wisconsin around this time, so the police department were hoping to be able to connect Ed to some of these other crimes. That sounds crazy considering the current population of that town is less than 1,000 people. That's smaller than the town I'm from, which is saying something. However, they were unable to tie Gein to any of these other deaths. So where did they get the bodies, or where did he get the bodies for all of these things that he did?
Right. They obviously couldn't identify the bodies. It was not the individuals that they were looking for of the people that had gone missing. So where did he get them? During the course of his investigation, Ed Gein admitted to digging up bodies from local cemeteries. It's reported that he retrieved the bodies from over 40 different graveyards, John. So it's not like he was going back to the same spot every time. Some have speculated that he got this idea while he was visiting his mother's grave, and he realized that there were a lot of other bodies under the earth around him that he had access to. Others believe that he was just really lonely, and he would dig these bodies up to seek companionship. All the bodies he dug up were of women, and while there was a variety of ages, most of them were middle-aged. He would spend time looking at the obituaries each day and looking for women that had passed away to see where they were going to be buried, see where the funerals were going to be held, and that's where he picked out the bodies that he was going to dig up. And I mean, when you look at Bernice Warden and Mary Hogan, there's a very striking resemblance to Augusta Gein. They're around the same age that Ed's mom was when she passed away. And they were heavier set women and really looked like his mom. So it seems like he targeted them specifically because they reminded him of his mother that he was so attached to. One thing we didn't mention earlier that was found in the home, John, was the makings of a female suit. Ed had actually put straps on the human skin from the abdomen and chest of one of the victims. And he would wear it around his house. Some people have called that a mammary vest. He would also make underwear from the genitalia of some of his female victims. So some have speculated that he was actually trying to build a suit to wear so that he could become a woman. Maybe even become his mother. While others believe it was really just about his sexual identity and that he wanted to be a woman. John, I'm like we talked about, I'm normally the one that gets uncomfortable and I'm on my phone during these episodes. I've been saying these words and feel very sick to my stomach right now. How are you feeling?
I'm surprisingly doing okay. I saw you on your phone just a little bit. And even as I'm saying that, you're looking at your phone. So I know how uncomfortable you are. I've never covered any cases in my professional career that involved like multiple deaths or the skin being ripped off another human, but I have to hear some awful, brutal stuff on a daily basis. So I think there's probably something wrong with me in that I'm not as, I'm a little desensitized to some of this stuff, I guess you could say. But you almost have to be right to do this kind of stuff social workers do every day. So, man, like I said earlier, Gein had confessed to killing both Warden and Hogan. However, when it came time to go to trial, he pled not guilty by reason of insanity, and he was actually deemed unfit to stand trial and was sent to a psychiatric facility where he spent a lot of time. While he was there, his house mysteriously caught fire and burned to the ground. Now, this happened just 10 days before there was going to be a public auction, which they were going to be selling the home and all of its contents. So at this point, all of the evidence had already been collected, of course. So there was nothing that had been destroyed that needed to be in the home. Some people speculated that authorities had actually set this fire intentionally to avoid the house becoming what would be called like a sideshow, where people would come into the land, come into the home and see it and pay to see the place where all these horrific things occurred. He was in this psychiatric facility for over 10 years before he would eventually be declared sane enough to go to trial for the murder of Bernice Warden. Jamie, it's interesting. I found that he was not tried for Hogan's murder, and people believe that this may have been to save the court money for a lengthy trial. The trial began on November 14th of 1968, and he was found guilty of killing Warden. But it was determined that he was, in fact, insane at the time of the murder, so he was then placed into a mental health hospital where he seemed to live happily ever after, right? He would go on to become the model resident. He got along with the other patients and lived a very peaceful life until he passed away on July 26th, 1984. Apparently, he had cancer and ultimately died of respiratory failure. I found this piece pretty interesting, Jamie. He was actually buried in a cemetery in Plainfield where his headstone was almost immediately stolen. And we can go into a little bit more about why, but it was recovered and then moved into an evidence room at the police station. It said that people still visit his burial site to this day and leave flowers and notes.
I realize this may sound hypocritical since you and I have recorded over 90 true crime podcasts where we discuss cases like this and spend a lot of our time researching killers and things like that. But I don't understand the fascination that would lead somebody to leave flowers or a note on the grave of a murderer.
Well, I mean, and even, you know, the headstone, we mentioned that it was stolen. It was vandalized and stolen. They put a couple of them out there and then they were eventually just all stolen. So they stopped putting them out, right? I heard that people would actually, one person had allegedly had the tombstone, and you know how you can take a sketch of a tombstone, like put a piece of paper and take your pencil and it would do like, just the words would pop out at you. You know what I'm talking about?
Like we used to do with leaves in elementary school.
Exactly. So apparently somebody had a tombstone. They were doing this and selling them. People were buying them. I don't know how much they were selling them for. More than $10 a piece is kind of what I heard. But police got wind of all this, and I think they were selling them on the website Craigslist. But anyway, police got wind of this. They executed a search warrant. They found the tombstone. The owner, I guess, or the alleged person thief. Yeah. Sorry, I'm having a hard time with words. Apparently, that guy was like, no. I made this. It's a replica. So I don't know if police really know if that's the actual tombstone or not. But it's interesting that people would pay money for that. I've heard other podcasters, like true crime podcasters, that collect crime memorabilia. So they'll have something that a murderer had, a famous murderer, and it's collectible to them. I don't think we own any of that stuff because we're not those kind of people.
We don't. And again, if you do that, I mean, you do you. I just can't wrap my mind. Because you're almost at that point, I feel like, supporting what happened. And I realize that you and I profit a very little bit from these situations. But I almost feel like that's in support. And I find it very odd. And I wonder who set that fire. I wonder if the police was involved or local authorities to try to keep people away. Or a family member just wanted it out of the way so that they would no longer be tied to it and it wouldn't keep coming up. Yeah, you just have to wonder who started that fire, because that's a very convenient time for that house to burn down. So, John, what do you think? I mean, we discussed this at times, and we've talked about the McDonald triad of serial killers. Usually, if somebody is a serial, not usually, but if somebody has a combination of arson as a child, cruelty to animals, and bedwetting beyond an appropriate age, they're more likely to have a violent future. We don't know any of those details about Ed Gein, but we do know that he had a very, I guess traumatizing is the right word, childhood, where his mother would isolate him, and I used the word brainwashed earlier, but really implant these really strong ideas in his head. What led to him becoming this person?
Well, I mean, we can only speculate, right? But obviously this guy had some major mental health issues, and I think that compounded with his upbringing just kind of culminated into the perfect storm of awfulness, right? Like, I don't think that you can take away, I don't think you can pinpoint this guy only had severe mental health issues. No, I think it was the fact that all of these things worked together to create the kind of person that Ed would ultimately become.
And that's kind of what I've, in my reading of the nature versus nurture theories, is kind of that I hate to make a gun analogy because I know that's a hot topic right now, but nature loads the weapon and then nurture pulls the trigger. So if you're mentally susceptible to certain behaviors, and then your life and your circumstances kind of can push you in a direction to move on those, predetermined instincts. But it can also, depending on your circumstances, can help you avoid that. So I agree. I think it's a big combination.
I would also be willing to bet that there's things that happened in his childhood and things that happened to him growing up that we just don't know about. I mean, looking at his childhood, I do see some big red flags, but, you know, these things have also happened to other people who didn't go on to commit murder on this scale or to do with what he did to bodies and things. So I think there's probably more to this story that we'll never really know.
So is he a serial killer? I mean, there were two murders with like a 3-year gap cooling off period. Killing somebody is like the worst thing you can do, right? But the other stuff he did is almost creepier than that. Is he a serial killer though?
I mean, we covered this on an episode earlier. What was the definition we gave? Is it two or more with a cooling off period?
Yeah.
So then, yeah, he meets our definition of a serial killer. You know, all these other body parts, you got to remember they came off bodies that were already dead. But, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if there was other victims that we just don't know about. And I don't want to sensationalize this or to add to it anything that's not true, but, you know, we have a pretty messed up guy here. And so is it out of line or out of reason to believe that there may be other victims that we just don't know about yet?
He didn't seem like the kind of guy that's going to brag about other murders take credit for murders just to build up his ego or something like that. So I think it's very possible that would happen. Some people would tie into the definition of a serial killer just kind of motive. Are they a sexual sadist? Are they narcissistic? Are they a psychopath? I think he could be most of those.
Yes, things. Yes, and yes. Yeah. Right. I think we know for sure that he killed the two women, but we ought to remember at the beginning of the story, he led police to his brother's dead body. And upon investigation, they found some deep bruising to his brother's head, but ruled it an accidental death by the fire. But, I mean, do you think it's possible that he killed his brother, too?
I think it's probable, to be honest with you. I feel like the evidence is there to support it. But given the chaos created by the fire and Ed's reputation, it wasn't looked into. Do you think he did it?
I think that if this were to happen today with the newer technology and the fact that they could do an autopsy, you know, you could determine if this kid was dead before the fire, right? You could look in their lungs and see if there's any soot or evidence of smoke inhalation. And maybe he did breathe and ultimately died of smoke inhalation. But was he knocked on the head unconscious and still breathing? So I don't know. I think today there's a lot more detective work we could do to figure that out. But the fact that he lost him in the fire, but then led police exactly to his body, and then the fact that he had deep bruising on his head, that's too many question marks for me to say that he for sure didn't do this. So, yeah, I think it's interesting and possible, I guess.
So beyond the murders, this is a kind of creepy thing that even we haven't covered here before, but how did his background manifest in manipulating bodies the way that he did? Like, we've talked about what can cause somebody to be violent, but what could cause somebody to dig up bodies and to create furniture out of skin? Like, how does your mind even get there from the way that he was raised, or in really in any way, unless you just read so much about it, that's what you start envisioning. And maybe that was it. Maybe it was the mental health plus the isolation plus the brainwashing plus the information that he got from reading so much. What do you think?
I don't know that I have a great answer for that. Honestly, I think he is just very, very messed up in the head. There was a lot of talk about, was this something sexual that he was doing, or did he want to become a woman when he would put on the, I'm going to say a woman suit, you know, the dead skin and whatnot. I guess, I don't know. I think I would fall more in line with Freud, right? That I think all this is like ties back to his sexual fantasies or sexual desires. I think it's, you know, we covered on Patreon a few months ago, the guy that kept the dead body in his house for years and years and years before authorities knew about it. And that was very much a sexual thing. And that's kind of what, I guess, in my mind, I picture is going on here, too. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it had to be because it was all women, because it was he did a lot of horrific things with their female anatomy parts. So I do think it's tied into some sexual piece. But again, you mentioned there are other things in the history that we don't know. Henry seemed to think that Ed's relationship with his mother was inappropriate. So were there things happening there, and how much does that relate? But again, that's just speculation. You mentioned earlier that you don't watch any movies. You and I have covered that extensively. But Ed Gein has gone on to, inspire the creation of several movie villains. I've actually never seen this first one. I know it's a very famous movie. But the killer in Psycho, played by Norman Bates, was kind of inspired by Ed Gein, particularly the mother issues came into play there. Have you seen that movie?
Surprisingly, yes, I have.
You've seen
that movie.
Psycho. Talk about it.
I watched it a few years ago, so I don't remember a lot of it. But I remember it being a very interesting and pretty good movie where a kid did have some mother issues, like an overbearing mother kind of figure. And yeah, that's the famous scene, right, where she's in the shower and he pulls a knife on her in the shower and stabs her to death. So pretty interesting movie. There's another one that's probably one of my favorite movies of all time. He was Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs. Have you seen that one?
Yeah, of course. That's one of the best movies of all time.
Yeah, so that movie is very, very good, very, very interesting. I remember I was probably in high school watching that movie, and it scared me to death. I don't get scared in, like, most scary movies where there's, like, a monster or demons or ghosts, stuff like that. I don't enjoy those movies at all. But these kinds of movies where things like this happen and are inspired by true things, those are the movies that scare the crap out of me. So Silence of the Lambs scared me to death.
Yeah, all the skin parts of Buffalo Bill and the lotion and... Yeah, I'm not going to go through the creepy lines, but yeah, that was all inspired by Ed Gein, as well as Leatherface in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which has had many sequels and remakes. But yeah, that's one of the most famous monster movies that you talked about, right?
Yeah.
So I don't love those movies either, but he is, and it's because there are so many different sides to what he did. This wasn't just a killer. This wasn't just somebody who manipulated bodies. This was somebody who, so many sides to the evil that he inflicted. Cannibalism, necrophilia, skin furniture, utensils made from bones, the sexual issues, and then the killing itself. There were so many pieces that you could take and make an interesting story from just that one part of the awful things that he did. But now we have these other movies, and I mean, there are also some documentaries about him, and I'm sure there are other horror movie villains that, I mean, have a little piece of Ed Gein's story in them. So there's just so many awful sides to everything he did. But John, as we saw, he was only convicted of one murder. So where's justice in this for anybody?
Yeah, I mean, the simple answer is there's not, right? There's not justice for Mary. There's not justice for all the people that he dug up. Each one of those people that he dug up deserves justice, and they got nothing. All the horrible things that he did to their bodies, all of that stuff goes essentially unpunished, in my opinion. You know, he spent all of his life after this in a mental institution, which was basically his own jail because they couldn't keep him in jail. But so he never got to see the light of day again. He died there, but there's no, like, legally there wasn't justice, in my opinion, for the other victims because they never went before a jury or went before a judge in those situations. Am I off base there or just being too hard or what?
No, I mean, he wasn't even charged for those or even the other murder. And I at the time, I think you mentioned it may have been financial issues for the DA's office or whatever, but there certainly wasn't justice. Yes, he spent the rest of his life in an institution until he passed away, but... justice just can't be done for everything. There's not enough justice for the bad stuff he did. And that's probably the biggest part of this for me, John. Like, we've covered some awful, awful things on this show. I don't know that any of them can top the awful things that Ed Gein did, or at least the creepiness level of the things that he did. Yet nobody suspected him of it. And I know that's the case. I know BTK had a family and nobody knew it. I know there are a lot of killers out there that lived normal lives outside of this, and people were surprised when they were caught. But to do this level of damage to lives, to bodies, to have that much in your closet, so to speak, like, how did people not see that? Are we that blind as a society when we just look at people on the surface and don't really understand what's going on in their lives? Or is it that easy for people to hide those skeletons in their closet?
No, I mean, you know, people want you to see what they want you to see. So they do things around other people to, you know, kind of put off the facade that they want you to see, right? So, you know, I think doing what I do, I question a lot of different people. I have a hard time trusting, but, you know, I think you never really know what's going on in someone else's house when it's just them or their family there. It's it's scary, man. You don't, you can see, you can try to see as much as you want, but you just really never know what's inside somebody's head and what goes on when nobody else is around.
Yeah, it's horrifying. It makes me not want to go outside, not let my kids go anywhere. But I mean, that's the, and again, this was in the 1950s. It's not like this was 2018, but this stuff still does happen. And it's super unfortunate. We hope you guys have been able to stick with us through this. I know this was one of our more graphic episodes. I hope you were properly warned about that. But this was certainly one of the most famous killers, villains, real life monsters of all time. So I felt like we had to bring it forward.
Jamie, thanks for doing it. Like I said, I was really shocked to see that you brought this case before us, but I'm glad you did. And guys, I hope you enjoyed it. If you wouldn't mind, some things you could do to really help the shows. First, free. If you could just take just a few minutes of your time to leave a rating and review. Those have slowed down a little bit. We'd like to see those pick back up. It really helps people out who are looking for new shows to catch our picture up there on iTunes or whatever where they're listening. So that would go a long way in helping us out. Also, you know, we're only 20 people away right now from the time of this recording to hit our 100 goal on Patreon. And we want to bless you guys for blessing us. We want to do a phone call with each and every one of you all. So we're researching ways to start scheduling those now, because we know that just in a few minutes here, a few weeks, hopefully you guys will step up and join us over on Patreon. We're going to do some phone calls with y'all. Ask us anything you want. I don't think anything's off limits. If it is, we'll just ask you to move on to something else to talk about. But we're really looking forward to those phone calls.
I am. And I do feel like, like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, we've had a good response to that already, and we're making good headway. So if we continue at this rate, we're going to be at 100 in a few weeks. So.
Yeah. So, guys, thank you so much for all you who have already signed up on Patreon. If you've been thinking about it and just haven't pulled the trigger yet, go on over there and do that. We also have shirts available at www.etsy.com. You can get a True Crimecast shirt for $25. And, guys, they're awesome. I feel kind of weird wearing it in public, but I do wear it sometimes because it's a nice shirt. I was really picky when we made these shirts. I wanted them made out of a good material that would hold up for a long time, and that's exactly what we got. So, you're missing out if you don't have one of those yet.
There's also other things on there. You can get stickers for just a few bucks. Stick those on your laptop, on your bumper, whatever. We also have coffee mugs, which I love the way those have turned out. So there are a number of things over there that you can purchase to support the show and get a little True Crimecast merch.
Guys, thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for sharing our podcast with your friends and people that are also interested in true crime. And until next crime, this has been True Crimecast.
You've listened to True Crimecast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.